Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Jott, and I'm here with my partner, Mark Pascal. Together, we own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We also own Catherine Lombardi, soon to be opened in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. Listen to us every day from 11 a.m. to 12 noon throughout Central Jersey. And reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, and we're podcasting all around the world. So keep listening and keep writing in from all around the world. We'd love to hear from you. Hi, Mark.
Hi, Francis.
Today, let's talk about, we have a great guest later on today, but today let's talk about our national eating pattern. And I want to talk about this. It was brought to mind by the demise of the, you can tell me the name of the corporation that just went out of business?
The Atkins.
The Atkins Corporation.
Absolutely.
Dr. Atkins has passed away. You look a little surprised there. We were talking about this on the way in, and the Atkins Corporation filed for protection because this is the fad diet that we ran so heavy to. They invested in the future. They invested very heavily.
I mean, it's amazing. I mean, this diet, we went from...
Everybody doing it.
I'm going to say 20 to 25% of the people in the restaurant saying, I'm no carbing, I'm low carbing, no bread for me, I'll have the big steak. Just fish, no carbs, no sauce, to 1 in 200, 1 in 300 people saying that they're on a diet.
It's crazy. It's really crazy. Well, and they went belly up, but I'll tell you, it's a long-standing tradition.
You said they went belly up.
Yeah, funny. That was funny. It's a long...
You didn't even know that was
no,
funny.
No, that was unintentional. I would like to take credit for that.
That makes it funnier.
Well, excuse me. I would like to talk about, overall, though, how Americans have sort of... We, unlike almost the rest of the world, which has very stable, or has until very recently, had most of the rest of the world has very stable eating rituals, very stable eating traditions, and the cuisines are very set. Now, we're in America, we're in the great melting pot, but we tend to leave our culinary traditions behind sometimes, and that makes us very prone to, number one, fad diets, and number two, to the whims of the corporate marketers who are trying to tell our children what to eat.
Mm-hmm.
I was struck by this article in the Times a while back. Let me read to you a little bit from this article, and it's by Michael Pollan, who's a great regular contributor to the New York Times. I recently asked my mother what her mother served for dinner when she was a child. The menu, full of such Eastern European Jewish delicacies as stuffed cabbage, cheese blintzes, tripe, bore absolutely no resemblance to the dinner my mother cooked for us. When I asked her why, she just laughed. You kids wouldn't have touched that stuff. True enough, and so for us, this being suburban New York in the mid-60s, she cooked a veritable world's fair of dishes, spaghetti and meatballs, beef Wellington, Chinese pepper steaks, beef bourguignon. I remember all of these dinners fondly, and yet I've never cooked a single one of them myself. In America, each generation's been free to reinvent its cuisine, and very often more than once. You know what? I'm sure that beef bourguignon wasn't very good, beef bourguignon.
But at the same time, Francis, you know, I love embracing the food of my ancestors, my mom, of my grandmother, of my great-grandmother. I love that stuff is passed down.
You're building a restaurant to do it, actually.
As a matter of fact, I am building a restaurant to do it. But I think you're right in that it's the exception rather than the rule. You know, times change and people want to change their food with it. What I wish is that we would take from those traditions and maybe add to them as opposed to subtracting from them.
I think that's the evolution of Italian cuisine and when a lot of cuisines come over. I mean, the Italian cuisine that we're going to be serving at the new restaurant, Catherine Lombardi in New Brunswick, is your grandmother's recipes. Now,
right.
Your grandmother
we're looking
was
for more of an old world restaurant. That's
well, and your grandmother was Italian American, and so this is an old world restaurant, and your family came
to
America.
Old world coming to the new world.
Exactly.
is what I meant.
So we see there another stable tradition of Italian American food. What's interesting in America is from the 70s it was always no fat, no fat, no fat, all everything's carbohydrates, and we switched immediately and went exactly
right.
In the opposite direction,
polar opposite,
and it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, these diets don't make sense in and of themselves, and this goes all the way back to I don't know the where Dr. Harvey Kellogg used to administer to patients his legendarily nutty sanitarium in Battle Creek, Michigan, an all grape diet,
The grapefruit diets.
Grape. Yeah. Oh yeah, and the grapefruit diets
right,
from when you were a kid.
That was a big one.
It's wacky. Okay, mm-hmm. But
what happens, Francis, is I think people don't want to change their habits. What they're looking for is a quick fix, and that's the American dream. Is I can just take a pill, take a painkiller, take whatever to make me feel better, and sometimes it, for total disregard of what the long-term effects of that you might be better off just changing your pattern of behavior.
But do you know what's very interesting? If you look at the whole French paradox thing...
I know it's very interesting. What I just said was very
in addition to that.
Excellent.
If you look at the whole French paradox thing, we look at the French, right? A bunch of like wine-swilling, cheese-eating, liver-eating people with no heart disease.
Right, all the bad stuff.
Right? But
they
people with no heart disease.
Stuff, yep.
And we look at them, and I'll tell you, it's like this. You look at a French lifestyle guy, gets up in the morning, kisses his kids, sort of gets to work, well, kind of on time, you know, works in the morning, then, you know, has a nice long lunch, maybe goes home and sees his wife, goes back to work in the afternoon.
By the way, probably gets drunk at lunch.
Come on, you're exaggerating. But has a half a bottle of wine at lunch, you know, or has a couple of glasses of wine at lunch, which is a half bottle, everybody, if you think I'm talking about, you think I'm exaggerating.
Francis, I worked and lived in France. A lot of those guys are drinking a whole bottle.
Long time ago. Anyway, so you go, you have a bottle of wine with your friends at lunch, you go back, you get precious little done in the afternoon, you go home, you kiss your wife, maybe you go out to dinner very late, you go to bed, you have some nice cheese, you get up the next morning, you go and do it again. That person has a little bit of liver and some bottles of wine and a bottle of wine during the day.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? American guy. Gets up in the morning, 5:30, commutes 2 hours to work.
46 ounces of coffee.
Has an Egg McMuffin, 46 ounces of coffee, and a supersized Coke. Gets to his desk. At lunchtime, he opens a paper bag or sends out for like a stromboli. Okay, eats the stromboli while sitting at his desk.
Eats without knowing that he's eating.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
You know, then at dinner time, he rushes to catch the 5:45, commutes 2 hours back home, barely sees his kids, eats something out of the microwave oven. And what we conclude... is that red wine is
must
the reason.
Must have been the wine. Absolutely.
And then what we do is American pharmaceutical companies are trying very hard to isolate the ingredient in wine that is the antioxidant that makes you, and that also that is the inhibitor of heart disease, so that you don't have to take the time to have a glass of red wine.
Right.
You can have it in a pill.
They're trying to make a red wine pill.
What's wrong with you? I said that with my Jersey accent very much on purpose. What's wrong with you?
What's wrong is that we don't have time to sit down and relax and have a glass of wine.
But that's why the French people don't have heart disease, okay, to the same level that we do. Because they don't eat as much fast food. They don't eat as much garbage food. They take the time to cook food, go to the green market.
Yeah, it's also why they get their butts kicked every war, though, Francis.
Well, you know.
Because they're like, we are the French. We all have some cheese and some wine, and we will sit here while
German soldier.
While you overrun our country.
All right. They're a little too relaxed sometimes. But, I mean, to look at that, I mean, but we had a tradition of eating whole food and eating good food here in this country, and I think that we sacrifice it too easily. We sacrifice it for the foods that are easy to get, that are convenience food. And if food is convenient, most convenience food, unless you're talking about like grapes and raisins,
mm-hmm.
there's a price to be paid for that. And there's also a price to be paid for not stopping.
Right.
And stopping work and sitting down with your family and looking at somebody and talking to them while you eat.
I think that And I don't have a huge problem with convenience food, but we have to realize that that is not for every day. That's for the one day every 2 weeks when you're running behind and you need to have something on the fly.
And
we've made that our breakfast.
And the finer things in life are taking a moment to sit down and enjoy whatever it is that you're eating, and hopefully to come together with somebody that you can talk to, maybe even somebody you can hold hands with over dinner and enjoy your life. That's our prescription from the Restaurant Guys. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Back with the Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, and our guest today is Larry Stone, who's a master sommelier and partner in Rubicon Restaurant in San Francisco. He's recently been named a new member of the Board of Trustees of the James Beard Foundation, and he's one of the top sommeliers in America, and as a matter of fact, he's one of the top sommeliers in the world. Larry, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Larry, how are you this morning?
Good. It's great to be here.
And early for you because you're 3 hours behind where we are.
Yes, it's very early for me.
Now, you are a master sommelier. We've had a couple of master sommeliers on, but mostly East Coast guys. You've been in Chicago, and you're also now out in Rubicon in San Francisco, and you've also been up in Seattle. So you've, and I've also know that you've done some events in New York through Newport's organization.
Uh-huh.
Do you find differences around the country in the role that you play or that the sommelier plays or the role that what people are looking for in a sommelier?
Are people looking for different things from you in different parts of the country?
I think yes. I think certainly in the Northwest or in California it's different than in New York. I think restaurants are different regionally as well. People's expectations of restaurants are quite different. But, you know, and also within a region there are lots of different expectations as well. So it's not just that there's one sommelier function or one expectation of what a sommelier will do, but it depends on the region and on the type of restaurant.
Well, what do you think that a sommelier's, I mean, at the core of it, what are we here for? What are sommeliers, what is the thing that we do that's best, that's most necessary?
Well, I think, well, whatever, it's providing a service to help the customer find a wine out of the thousands and thousands of products out there that they'll like. That will also complement their dinner and
uh-huh.
their budget. So there's a lot of things. That, you know, an average person picking up a wine list, let's say they go to an Italian restaurant these days, and there are all these new wines from Campania or from Basilicata or from wherever, you know, and they don't know. They don't know what they are. They know, well, I've had a Chianti before. Is that like that? You know, so you're able to answer basic questions about the kind of wines. And you're able to, like, point out the different producers and
to set up some new expectations.
Yeah, so that you can try new things because there's so much happening. People want to know what's going on, but they don't have the ability to taste all the thousands of wines that are coming out. And in a restaurant, the sommelier has that option and has pre-tasted everything. So they're basically, that's the primary function of a sommelier is to help guide people through a minefield of new events, new wines that they've never had.
Yeah, we're lucky, Larry. It's a tough job, but somebody's got to do it. You know?
That's what I always tell my customers.
Well, you know, it's interesting. One of the things that we always talk about is when we visit a restaurant, whether we know more about the people who run that restaurant or not, there are people who come into my restaurant who know more about my wine list than I do, certainly. But when you're in someone else's restaurant, I encourage people to always talk to the sommelier because no matter what you know about wine, about the wines in your cellar and with the wines in that sommelier's, with that food in that restaurant.
Right, and under his purview.
Then I think that person should know more about those. The first job of a sommelier is to know more about his or her particular cellar than anyone else. Would you agree
yes.
with that?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Should definitely know more. I mean, I think that's a real problem in some restaurants where there's someone there that doesn't know really enough about all the wines and is able to guide them through. And the people come in and they seem to know more than the sommelier. That's not a very good image to present.
No, it's definitely not.
You know, one of the interesting things I find, though, working on the other side of it as well, because I often work the floor as a sommelier in my own place and for other people as well sometimes, is I find the customer who comes in with a knowledge of scores from the Spectator or the Wine Spectator or the Wine Advocate, and they know the things that they've read about wines, and they have these preconceived notions, and they want wines of a certain score or a certain power, almost without regard to the food. I mean, how do you react to that? I mean, of course, professionally, we give the customer whatever they want, but what are your feelings on that, and do you think that we can make headway with regard to that?
Well, I really don't find it to be that much of an issue on the West Coast. It might be, you know, I think in the East, being farther away from all the wines and things.
And pushier.
What?
And pushier out here. We're kind of pushy people.
I don't know about that, but I think people just out here are, you know, they're not so point conscious. They're able to visit wineries. They have relationships with wineries and winemakers, and they have their own favorites, regardless of what critics like. They might read their critics. They might say, oh, did you see that review? You know, it was terrible. I still like the wine. You know, it's like... it's like anything. At one point in our lives, we probably had to read Brian Miller or someone in order to even step foot in a restaurant, or we had to read Pauline Kael or someone to feel that the movie was worth going to. But I think at some point, you know, you see enough films and you go to enough restaurants, you feel like you can trust your own judgment.
Sure, you create your own frame of reference.
Yeah, and you kind of critique the critics in a way. You have your own frame of reference, and that's a way you can actually say, about a review, well, you agree with it or don't agree with it, and have a fairly high degree of confidence in your own opinion. And that's happening with wine, I think. More and more people, there's more critics nowadays, I think. You know, you see a proliferation of critics, and you see the blog, the bloggers out there talking about wines, and they might not always agree with the critics. And I think in the West Coast, we have a huge base of people that, you know, live in proximity to wineries and, all up and down the coast, and they have their own opinions and their own alliances and allegiances. Whereas in the East Coast, perhaps you're a little more remote from wine. So there's some good ones in Hudson Valley and in Long Island and upstate New York, but the quantity here, there are thousands of wineries here.
Well, I think one of the most interesting things in our industry is the increasing professionalism and the number of young people who are entering it and pursuing a course of study, of which you hold one of the top degrees, is the degree of Master Sommelier. And we're going to talk more about that when we come back. We're talking with Larry Stone, Master Sommelier, and one of the top sommeliers in the world. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, and the time is 11:25. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. We're talking with Larry Stone, Master Sommelier and partner in Rubicon Restaurant out in California, one of the certainly the top sommeliers in America and, frankly, one of the top sommeliers in the world. We've talked about the role of a sommelier, Larry, and when you come to a restaurant, his primary job is to find you great wines and make sure that you don't, that you to make sense of a rather large list. You're sort of the walking explanation of the list. But And we've said that the primary responsibility of the sommelier is to know in his or her cellar everything that's in there and how well it goes with different foods so they can help you find a bottle of wine. But you know more than that. You're a master sommelier. You hold a couple of different master sommelier degrees that we'll talk about later in the show. Charlie Trotter's called you a genius of our time as far as wines. I mean, you've got, you know, you can smell.
No, it wasn't as far as wines. He was talking about just the fact that he's a genius.
It's been said that you can It's been said that you can smell the kind of cologne that I'm wearing here in New Jersey from where you sit in San Francisco. Now, why do we need?
I'm in the same room with him. Don't worry about it, Larry.
We need, you know, super sommeliers like you? Because we do. But what role do you play? Because you have all this knowledge and this position, what's your role in the wine?
That's about as loaded a question as we'll ask, Larry. Go for it.
Oh, it's a tough one to answer. What is my role? I often wonder that when I wake up in the morning, too. What am I doing? I'm having a good time, so I guess part of the role is to infect other people with that sense of joy that I have when I taste good wine and good food.
I like your choice of words, infect, there. That was very good.
I mean, it's a contagious. I think it's a great kind of a contagious endeavor to get people excited about something that really is enrich you know, my life, but it also enriches can enrich a great number of people. And I see from a poll that the LA Times just did recently that for the first time in history, wine is more popular than beer.
Yeah, that was a big move we made this year.
Yeah, and so that shows me that you know, what I've been doing and hundreds of other people have been working at over the years has finally had some real impact. And I think, you know, the enjoyment of wine with meals is an aesthetic pleasure that can grace any table in America. You don't have to be wealthy to enjoy wine and food together. I think that's the highest calling that we can have, and that's what I try to do.
Well, we can buy decent wines now that are only a little bit more expensive than a bottle of soda.
Yeah.
That's right. And in some cases, they're less.
Yeah, exactly.
And there's a whole new generation of wine people out there that are following in your footsteps, Larry, and I do want to talk about that. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
A Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal here with my partner, Francis Schott. We own Stage Left Restaurant in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon or reach through restaurantguysradio.com. Today, we have a guest, Larry Stone, Master Sommelier, and Sommelier at a great restaurant in San Francisco called Rubicon, where he's been for quite some time. You know, I was fortunate enough to drink wine fairly young. My parents were
French.
Well, my mother was French. My father was French. My mother was Italian. But how did you get into this business and become so involved with it?
Well, I think it's a similar background to you. I have a European family. My father worked at the Pike Place Market in Seattle, and that was some of my first impressions about food, how to deal with, you know, dealing with farmers and with what we call the Highstallers, who were produce brokers and the sausage makers and all that from Europe also, and the fishermen. So I love food. I love going around the Pike Place Market and eating fresh stuff that people gave me as you know, since I was a little kid.
I hear that's one of the most exciting markets in the country.
Yeah, and especially when I grew up, it was a real farmer's market. Now it's more of a kind of a tourist attraction. It has evolved a little bit and become, you know, the buses pull up and people walk through and don't really buy anything. But when I grew up, it was a real market and restaurants and large, you know, concerns that needed food bought local produce there and fish.
Yeah, but a lot of people grew up there, Larry. You grew up and then became, like, one of the top sommeliers in the country with, like, you know, a great nose and a great palate and a wealth of knowledge about this one specific topic. How did that happen to you? How did you make that evolution from someone who's just a normal food lover to being Larry Stone, Master Sommelier?
That's a pretty big jump for most of us.
Well, what happened, I think, mainly is, you know, I grew up in a neighborhood where I'm about 5'4", and I wasn't, like, the strongest guy, and I grew up in a neighborhood where sports were very very popular, and I wasn't quite the football or basketball kind of guy. So even though I played tennis and skied, it was not like that would get me anything in my neighborhood. But so I started cooking meals and things at a very young age. I started cooking candies for my classmates when I was like in second grade, and also I was just fascinated about wine and food. I watched Julia Child on TV, and I started cooking with my mother. She worked, and I helped her out. So that by the time I was 7, I was making things for my classmates, and I was blind tasting at home because
at 7 I was making toast,
yeah.
Man.
Well, I was a little more advanced. I made jam and I made candies and cakes.
And you were blind tasting
wine? Potash chew and cream puffs. I love cream puffs anyway. So I did this when I was like in elementary school. By the time I was in high school, I was making souffles and all sorts of stuff for my friends when they'd go to the football. I hated watching sports, so they'd go to the football games and I'd have like a gourmet meal ready for them. And I found also, and you know, this is an important thing for an adolescent, is that being able to cook well, you know, gave me some credibility with women. You know, they thought, well,
nice.
You know, it was a good way to entertain. And I knew, and by the time I was in college, I also threw parties where I, instead of having a kegger, I'd have, you know, wine, Cote de Rhone.
A foie gras. Sure.
It's a little more sophisticated than the average college party.
So why did you not go into becoming a chef, and where did you make the turn to become a sommelier?
Well, I didn't ever really intend to become a sommelier. I just liked wine, and I went into chemistry. I made wine also when I was about 14. I made wine. I made whiskey when I was about 15, 16. And
I wish I was friends with you.
Yeah, well, I didn't get to enjoy the fruits of the whiskey. I got to drink the wine, but the whiskey got confiscated because I had to make that in the school lab, and they figured out what I was doing. So I drank it. It was pretty good stuff, actually.
Oh, hold on. Now, Larry, I just want you to know, I took advanced chem in high school. We never made whiskey, not one single time.
Because you were a smart person.
Yeah,
high school was a little creative. I mean, we had one guy who was making explosives in our high school lab.
I mean, I had to dissect frogs. You guys are making whiskey. This doesn't seem fair.
The explosive guy I don't want to hang out with. The whiskey guy I want to hang out with. Are you sure? Are you a little Irish at all, Larry? Any Irish
no.
in you?
No. No Irish.
Just checking. We have coming up now. The business has really changed. Mark and I are both 40. And when we were coming up in the business, when we were working our way through college before we decided we wanted to do this as a career, and when we first decided to do it as a career, there were people who had gotten degrees like yours, the Master Sommelier degree, and there's also the Master of Wine degree. But it was nowhere near the number of people who are pursuing a more formalized education as are today. I mean, and people really look up to you. I mean, we have a There's a gentleman named John Kafarski who's working for us right now who just sort of idolizes you, and he's pursuing his Master Sommelier degree.
Very upset that we wouldn't let him come on the show today, by the way.
And that's sort of been a change in the increasing professionalism of this industry overall. Do you think that young people really need to pursue a course of formal study, or do you think this is a great resource that's available to kids today that wasn't available to young people coming up, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago?
Oh, I think so. I mean, there's a lot more. I mean, the Court of Master Sommeliers today is just doing an enormous amount of outreach and education, and, you know, they've trained thousands and thousands of people to just at the basic level. They've taken an introductory course, and hundreds have passed the advanced course, and almost, I'd say, I'm not sure what the exact figure, but I'd say close to 1,000, and 73 now have passed the Master Sommelier test, so there's a lot. I was number 8. And when I took it, there was no help at all. It was all just working on my own. And
well, there were 7 people to help you, is what.
No, they didn't help me. They had just passed themselves. There were a few that passed, and we were so geographically diverse, and there was no way to get help. When we met each other, like at wine events or something, we'd ask, you know, kind of grill each other, test each other out to see.
Why didn't you guys just email each other?
Yeah, we didn't have email either. Sorry. No, it was tough. So now it's a lot easier. There's a lot going on. There are a lot of study groups all over the country, and people are really, you know, progressing fast. I think the sommelier art in this country is really, in the last 5 years, has taken, you know, huge leaps and bounds.
Would you share with our listeners, because a lot of people don't realize that, you know, how sort of grueling this is. I mean, a Master Sommelier degree is like getting a master's degree or even higher. Why don't you tell people, to achieve a Master Sommelier degree, what sort of things someone needs to learn and master?
Well, I think there's so much that it's hard to get into, but we basically cover service, you know, as one aspect, you know, wine service and food and wine matching is part of that, and even knowing about cocktails and cigars. And then there's the.
I want to share with you one story. Is that I had dinner shortly after Rubicon opened with a winemaker, a guy named Donald Patz, and Donald's a big fan of cigars. And I came in and we had not met, and I brought Donald some Cuban cigars, which I've had since before the revolution. Of
clearly,
course,
otherwise
I didn't buy
they would be
them,
illegal,
right, of course. And I brought him some. He likes big cigars, so I brought him some cigars called Lusitanias. Okay,
these are.
Yeah, and that's what you did to me. And I said, now these are very unusual. You won't see these around very often. They're Cuban and they're called Lusitanias. And I put them on the table, and he was very impressed. He said, oh, very unusual. That's great. And from across the room, you walked over to the table and said, oh, Lusitanias. So I want to thank you for taking the wind out of my sails, Larry.
Sorry.
But you're really good at your job. So how do people go? Like, what sort of things do they learn? Is it grape varieties? Is it the technical aspects? Is it service? And how do they go about learning it today as opposed to when you were kind of coming up through the ranks?
Well, they work with other people that have passed. They're more, you know, now they're 73. So regardless of where you live in this country now, there's someone, the first person from Puerto Rico just passed, although he works in Chicago now, but they're the first people that are, well, I was the first one in the Northwest, but the second one in the Northwest finally passed this year. And I had moved away from the Northwest shortly after passing, so he's there and he's able to train people there. And plus, with the number of master sommeliers there are, they travel around. And basically, the important thing to do is get into a study group, practice blind tasting every week, get in touch with, if you can, with a master, and you know, so your group can have some guidance. That's amazing. You know, the quantum leaps that have happened in terms of dissemination of information this way.
But still, realize that we're talking about 73 people in
America.
Well, in the United States. There are more people playing Major League Baseball. Okay, you got a better chance of going from AAA to the majors and making it to the top. We'll be right back with Larry Stone. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Central Jersey time is 11:45.
Back with The Restaurant Guys, and our guest today is Larry Stone, Master Sommelier and partner in Rubicon Restaurant in San Francisco, and he's also recently been named a member of the new Board of Trustees of the James Beard Foundation, which is a troubled foundation that had some trouble that originated here in New Jersey with a New Jerseyan who was formerly the chairman of the board. And they've really done some tremendous efforts to reconstitute this board because the James Beard Foundation is such a great idea. And I think that with the new board, we have hopes of seeing that idea come to fruition more than we did with the old.
Well, I think we have some good people who are going to help bring us out of a tumultuous time for the James Beard Foundation.
And Larry, you're one of those people. Can you talk to us a little about the James Beard Foundation and where it's going and sort of stepping into this rather difficult situation?
Yeah, what's happening now is that we bring on a board of professionals. I think the first part of the history of the James Beard Foundation was one of people who were friends with or friends of James Beard, and they were well-meaning, but they weren't necessarily the most organizationally oriented people or didn't have a lot of background in running organizations. And although they loved food, they weren't that active. They were active in the events, and they loved chefs, but oversight was just something that they weren't familiar with.
It had such good ideals, and then it just seemed to go awry here.
I think that they were trusting people, and they had the best of intentions, and they thought everyone else did, but unfortunately someone got in there who didn't have the best of intentions and was able to manipulate them. And I think now what we're doing is trying to focus on the professionalism of the board, and we brought in people that are the highest powered people, like Jim Hogue, who is with the Council on Foreign Relations, runs Foreign Affairs magazine, and he's on the Pulitzer Prize Ethics Committee, and he's going to come in and help work with us on ethics, on reorganizing and codifying the rules for judging awards. And we have Jason Wright, who works with Merrill Lynch, and he's a communications officer. He works a lot with organizations and how to structure them so that they function properly from all elements.
And what are the goals of the James Beard Foundation? What is the James Beard Foundation? I mean, we give these culinary awards every year, and that's a separate board, but also the foundation itself, what is the ongoing purpose of the James Beard Foundation?
Well, basically, it's to celebrate and promote, fine cuisine in America and to continue, in a way, what James Beard did, which was to popularize and to bring forward to the American public the glories of American cuisine, but also to show the roots in European cuisine and to celebrate great cuisine anywhere in the world. And America, that is America. America is a cross-section of cuisines from all over the world.
You said earlier your parents were from Europe. My parents were from Europe. Francis is three generations out of Europe. I mean, it's...
You know, one of the things that I want to talk about with the James Beard Foundation, just so everyone knows what it is that we're talking about, the James Beard Foundation was founded on some financial irregularities. There were some problems there, and things went awry, and a lot of good people for many years put forth a lot of efforts to promote American cuisine. And I think that the James Beard Foundation played a role in the rise of our contemporary view of American cuisine and was very important. But it's like running a restaurant. I mean, I know very often we do a lot of restaurant consulting, and we'll consult for people who can throw a great party, and the restaurant is actually, they do pretty well for a time every night, and the evening itself is great, but the underlying structure of the business isn't financially sound, and that's just not sustainable in the long term. And I think what's happened with the Beard Foundation is, with the increasing professionalism in our industry, it needed to professionalize as well. And I think that, Larry, it's great that they have a voice like yours on the board.
Well, thank you very much.
So let me ask you one last thing. You're out in San Francisco, and San Francisco and New York are like the two hottest food towns and the most exciting food towns in America.
Well, Chicago's up there too, but you were there too.
Yes,
so,
that's true.
So what's going on out in San Francisco? Have you seen San Francisco evolve over the last 10 years with regard to food and wine and fine dining overall?
Oh, it's just become a lot more. I mean, San Francisco has always been a hotbed of culinary ferment. When you go back to...
Always comes down to wine with you, doesn't it, Stone?
Yeah, it does. I know. I always think that way. But you start with the movement in Berkeley with Alice Waters and what she did and how she changed Americans' perspective on French food, even. I mean, that's what her focus was.
Well, she's doing some great things now, changing hopefully our schools with the Edible Schoolyard program.
Right. I mean, she's doing so many unique things and important things that are at the vanguard of the way we think about food. And it's not just the Edible Schoolyard, but it's a whole sustainable farming and promoting the farmer, looking to the farmer rather than looking at the finished product. You know, and And I think that, you know, what she's done and what Charlie Trotter has done in Chicago with that, you know, also it's had some sort of effect nationally. I think I'm sure that in New York there are also programs now that...
Sure. It's affected us as restaurant owners. I can't tell
and
you. Absolutely not.
If you look at the Blue Hill at Stone Barns project, that's just very much the same sort of thing. And I think it's very interesting to look at the same exact thing going on with wine when we look to things and how they're produced and that they're produced from small farmers. Hey, Larry, I want to thank you for taking the time to talk with us from across the country and tell people in New Jersey about all the great things that are going on in California and in the food world, in the wine world in general.
Thanks so much, Larry.
All right.
It's been more than a pleasure.
And after the break, we're going to tell everybody what Blue Hill at Stone Barns is,
extraordinary.
Francis.
And we're going to put up on our website, we're going to put a link to Rubicon out in California. We're going to put up some information about Larry Stone so you can pursue your interest and find out more about one of the top sommeliers in America and one of the top sommeliers in the world. You're listening to The Restaurant Guy, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55.
Hello and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark Pascal and Francis Schott. Our guest today was Larry Stone, Master Sommelier and partner of Rubicon Restaurant in San Francisco.
Not just Master Sommelier, but the seventh Master Sommelier in America.
Seventh of 73. I said this before in the show. 73. Okay, that's 10 times fewer than there are major leaguers.
And by the way, and thousands of people are studying and trying to be master sommeliers. I know many people who've tried and then stopped trying, and many people who are still
more people
trying.
Have hit 300 home runs in their careers.
So in case you're wondering about professionalism in the wine industry, having the 2 degrees that you can get from in wine that matter are the master...
You don't seem amazed by the more people have hit 300 home runs in their careers, Francis.
That's because Larry Stone, I have no sports reference at all. But when you think about it, I mean, when you have a Master Sommelier degree, when you have an MS or a Master of Wine degree, which is an MW, those are legitimate degrees. Those are like graduate level degrees. Mm-hmm. And, you know,
they're like doctorate level degrees.
Sure, because, if you want to hire a PhD, how many are there in the country on any subject?
Right.
If you want to hire a PhD in wine, there are 73 Master Sommeliers and about as many Masters of Wine in the country.
Yep.
And if you look at the restaurant business and the wine business, how big is it? It's pretty big. It's not like this is there's not that much demand for these guys.
And I'll tell you something. For all the knowledge of subjects like this that Francis and I have, be it small or large, we simply don't have the time to get accredited in these in courses.
And
like
this is a years long process.
Investing time, I mean, just a crazy amount of time to be certified in these areas.
Well, and the other thing is, you know, when we came up through the business, if you wanted to be a wine expert, if you wanted to be noted as a wine expert, you certainly could, and you would do it by apprenticeship. You would do it by traveling, which is what we did. We went to different wine regions. We learned from. We got letters of introduction to different winemakers and spent time working in different wine shops and
went to a ton of reading. Went to Portugal, went to Spain.
And that is a great way to come up. But at the time we were coming up, there were 7 master sommeliers in the country. Now, I would say that to someone who is just getting started in the business, that to pursue a degree in wine, and we're going to put up on our website how you would go about find the International Court of Master Sommeliers or the Court of Masters of Wine to direct someone to do that. If you want to have professionalism in the wine business and pretty much write your own ticket as far as a job, that's a very good place to go. And that's our advice from you. We're the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450, and the time is 12 noon.